This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 190 for Wednesday, May 4th, 2016. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. We cover everything from movies and television to books, apps, and websites. Back again, doubleheader, is Mr. Hammond Chamberlain. I was going to use the House of Chamberlain, and I completely forgot. The joke was all set up, and I just completely botched it right there, live on the show. So, welcome.
Habits are hard to break, and that's okay.
You do almost 200 of these things, and the intro-outro kind of rolls off the tongue most of the time. Believe you me, there are some moments, if I could go back and re-record all the spiel at the end of the show, because I'm either tired, tongue-tied, or I've just said it too much, and you just start to, I've got a handle on this, I can just ad-lib it. Nope, no, you can't. Not when it comes to reading advertisements.
Or you get to the point where you're so comfortable with it that it becomes one sentence, like one giant word with no breaths, no punctuation, nothing.
Yep. It's funny, a couple weeks ago, it's only been a week. It's crazy how busy I've been. Last week, I interviewed Jean-Baptiste Monge on the Comics Coast to Coast podcast that I do. And him and his wife, Margot, are from France, currently living in Quebec in Canada, in Montreal, or outside of Montreal. And English is the second language. And on top of that, France is a whole different French than Quebec. To be on the interview, I had to speak a little bit slower. And it's hard to do that without sounding, in my head, patronizing. But he said it was very good because he was able to keep up with the conversation. Because I'm a bit of a fast talker, especially when I get onto something that I'm really passionate about, like artwork, and his artwork is beautiful. I find it hard, and I'm constantly reminding myself when I'm reading the intro, outros of this show to slow down.
I actually had that very same experience when I interviewed Driving Mrs. Satan. Mm. They're both, English was like not their native tongue. I think they're both Italian or something. And I had to speak very slowly, and I felt like I was being kind of insulting to them. But when I was done, they're like, no, you were good. Thank you for trying to be slow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I get that internal clock that you have when you talk seemed to go on forever. And I felt like I was being kind of crappy to him, but no.
I find too that when I speak slower, I use less ums and ahs and maybes and all that kind of stuff.
What was that?
That was a motorbike.
Oh, okay. I thought you'd flushed a toilet or something.
Nope. No. I'm not sure what it is these days about the microphone picking up all kinds of stuff from outside the window. It never used to. Of course, we're also coming into springtime. Gosh, dare I say it out loud? It snowed 2 days before my birthday. and then on my birthday, I was out for a run and it was like 10 degrees. So, the weather around here is messed up, and I know I'm breaking the cardinal rule of the Citadel Cafe, but still. So now in the evenings when I'm podcasting, I've got the window open, so that might be part of the problem. In the dead of summer, I have a air conditioner, so I'll crank that on before the show, and then I'll do the show in the cool quiet, and then turn it back on after. The thing about, speaking slower on podcasts for me has always been... It's harder when you are the host or speaking with other people that you podcast with a lot, because you and I have done enough shows together that we understand each other's voices, inflections, speed, and that I think makes it easier to understand. Even when you start to really get going, I can still follow. I listened to an interview recently, and I won't do any call-outs, but it was impossible to understand this person. It was a technical interview. They were talking about art and creating something, and they were talking so fast and mumbling that it was it was just impossible. And I felt bad for the hosts because you could even tell that they were struggling to hear. And then you lace on top of that a bunch of Skype issues and stuff, and it was just it was almost a waste of time. That's, I mean, for Skype aside, I mean, I understand that Skype is frustrating, but so many people, when they get in front of a podcast, and maybe they're nervous and stuff like that, but we always try to create, one thing we try to pride ourselves on with Comics Coast to Coast is creating a very relaxed environment, a very casual conversation, so that the artists that we interview, because artists are kind of notoriously a little bit shy, they're not put on the spot, and then they don't mumble or speak too fast or whatever. They feel very chill and they can kind of get their points across. And I have to knock on wood, we've had some great guests on the show as of late. It's been really, really cool. Who are we interviewing tomorrow? Eduardo Vieira? I'm horribly mispronouncing his last name, I'm sure. But check that out tomorrow. He's a fantastic, phenomenal artist. His stuff is so good. And he works in traditional media. So it makes me kind of giddy whenever we have somebody on that does pen and ink stuff. And I'm just like, yes.
Speaking of pen and ink stuff, I can't wait to show you guys my masterpieces for the Artist Roundtable.
Ooh, right. Right. I can't wait to show you my non-existent masterpieces for the Artist Roundtable. Actually, I have scheduled my Mondays now to a block of my Monday morning to work on that stuff until the showtime.
Yeah, Phil submitted his a month ago.
Is Phil in the chat room?
He is.
Phil is in the chat room. Screw you, Phil. Making the rest of us look bad. Jeez.
It's his third year. It's old hat.
It's all right. Carter Johnson is going to show up 3 days before the show and just put us all to shame, right?
Yeah, the only reason I'm sending those emails out once a month is because of Brian.
Oh, Dunaway, yes.
Yeah.
I know exactly who you mean. Love you, Brian. But yes, I for those of you that don't know, I podcast with Brian on a regular basis. I can understand that. He's also a very busy guy. We actually, it was really unfortunate. This interview with JB Monge, I had to do it by myself. Because Brian got tied up at work. So he's been so busy that even work is keeping him past work hours. And then he's got, kids and life and family and all that kind of stuff too. So we have to be careful there, with our schedule. So, something that I really, need to tip my hat to you for, your interviews on Beyond the Playlist are just so well paced. And I say again, casual in the comfort level way, because that was my first time solo interviewing someone.
Uh-huh.
And to make it even more intimidating, JB was in the studio here with me in Halifax. So we were face to face.
Oh, wow.
I kept it really short because we all were going out to dinner afterwards and Brian and Matt didn't get a chance to talk to him. So we thought we would do just a mini interview and then we would have him back later on in May. So that's what we're going to do. But just even a 20-minute interview without the banter and padding from co-hosts and stuff, it felt very formal because, Brian wasn't making fun of me. Matt wasn't, interjecting and bringing one conversation. When Brian and I get sidetracked, Matt jumps in and goes, "Well, I'm going to bring us right back on track here, gentlemen." And, none of that was happening. It was just me and JB and a few English prompts from Margo in the background. And that was it. So it was challenging and it was only 20 minutes. So hats off to you, man. I don't know how you do, lengthy interviews when it's just you.
Well, I got to tell you, sometimes I really base it a lot on the person I'm talking to. Perfect example. I already have put this in the notes for later, but I'll bring it up now. I interviewed Will Bates, who is the composer of all the music for the TV show The Path that's on Hulu.
Oh, cool. Brock and I were talking about that 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so I interviewed him, and when we got on, he's like, "Okay, I have a little less than an hour, go." And so my interview with him ran 35 minutes maybe. And I feel like I covered all the things I needed, but he was really watching the clock. And so therefore I was really watching the clock. But I covered all the stuff, it's fine. But then just the other day I interviewed Mark Degliantoni, who was in Soul Coughing. He was the keyboardist for Soul Coughing, and he and I talked for 90 minutes. Mm. And it was like I'd known him, and it was awesome. And I'm like, hey, if you ever have anything else you want to talk about, I'll make room for you because you were great. And like Xander Berkeley, I talked to him for a little over an hour. Abby Miller, she and I hit it off after she found out I had lived in Nebraska for a while. That was like a common thing. And next thing I know, we're exchanging emails on the regular. I mean, it's just kind of interesting how some people, you get the feel for them and you can slide into that comfort level, and all, then there are others where it always stays kind of formal. And then I've had a couple, one of the ones that I was really excited to do, but kind of fell flat, was a guy who I really admire his work. And I felt like my interview style was a bit much for him because I think he just didn't know how to answer some of the questions. Mm. He's a musician, and I had to adjust the way I asked my questions to make him kind of relax about halfway through because it wasn't working. And it was interesting. It was one of the ones where I feel like I kind of let him down as an interviewer because I think I didn't let him shine.
Mm. It's tough. We run into that now and again when you've got some art on the show for Comics Coast to Coast that's really, really good. And you know that the artist knows their stuff, but through shyness or language barrier or for like whatever reason it is, they find it very hard to talk about it. And it's usually, if you can find anybody that is an entrepreneur, like people that are just kind of making art for art's sake, which is wonderful, they tend to be the shy, more introverted of our, you know, general interview populace. But when you have somebody that's running their own business or speaks at any kind of events and stuff like that, even people that do conventions, they tend to be way more outspoken. And if they're doing something funny too, like if it's a drama graphic novel, then they're usually quieter people. But if it's like a comic strip or something goofy and funny, then generally people are a little more verbose and easier to get going. My favorite interviews are like the ones where you ask one question and they just go on for like 5 or 10 minutes. And even if they don't, sometimes they answer a couple more questions that you already had lined up, but sometimes they don't, and they just kind of go into all kinds of different tangents and lead you down different paths. And those are my favorite kind of interviews. And it's funny, those are always the ones when the interviewee apologizes for rambling on so much. And we're like, no, this is our favorite thing.
Actually, I've had people say that. They're like, oh, I'm sorry, I talk too much. I'm like, that's the format of the show. And if people don't like it, they can pound sand. That's what this show is all about.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially my show. I mean, it's exploration inside their brain. That's kind of what I'm doing. I'm not really talking about a particular project. I'm not really talking about a specific event. I'm talking about the overall history and process with these people. Mm. And if projects or events come up, that's because they brought them up typically, or I'm kind of using it as a launching point to get into a different topic. Mm. But you know, when they're done, they're like, oh, I'm sorry, I talk too much, I tend to ramble. No, you're totally fine. I am not going to tell anyone on my show to stop talking because I love hearing the things they have to say.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's funny when you say that, I picture you with like a pickaxe and a miner's helmet dropping down into someone's ear, just looking for the gems. Well, speaking of interviewing people and hearing from people, we actually have some listener email. We should probably get to that before we get too into the show. Yeah, I meant to read this last week or the week before, but I unfortunately didn't have time. It's from John Bailey, and he writes, Joel, I used to follow your postings on Ello before I canceled my Ello account, but I'm still subscribed to the Citadel Cafe podcast. Fantastic, I'm glad you are. A couple thoughts about Supergirl, which is good because Hammond is on the show too. I quite enjoy it, but there are a few little things that bug me. Supergirl and her pierced ears. Yeah, I know the old how does Superman shave question. Maybe she had someone take a kryptonite needle to pierce her ears. I hope you have seen the season finale by this time. During the fight between Supergirl and Alex, I should say spoilers here just in case we get into some stuff. So if you haven't seen the season finale, pause, people. I kept wondering why Supergirl didn't use her heat vision to disable the kryptonite costume Alex was wearing, or why she didn't pick up something and knock the sword out of her hand. Remember when Martian Manhunter shapeshifted into Max Lord to get into the room where the Bizarro Girl was? And when when he first entered the DEO as Hank Henshaw, who didn't know that was Martian Manhunter? Was it really necessary to give us a shot of his red eyes? The writers often seem to hit us over the head like that because we must be too stupid to have figured it out ourselves. These little criticisms aside, I have enjoyed Supergirl and look forward to season two, if there will be one. I believe there is, as far as season two. Thanks very much for writing in, John. That was a great email. And I agree. I'm going to tie this in with a little Flash comment I have, and we won't get into Flash because it'll be a complete sidetrack. But this week's episode of Flash, the writing was solid gold shit. And it was the exact problem that you mentioned with the writers beating you over the head with the plot because they have to fill a 45-minute episode and they've only written 20 minutes. And I feel that almost all television shows that run 20-plus episodes per season run into this problem. And I absolutely agree. I like the heart of Supergirl. I enjoy the spirit of the show. It's a little fluffy, but that's okay because I'm not the target demographic, right? I accept that it's aimed at younger people and probably younger female viewers more than me. But beyond that, I do get sick of the writing. Supergirl could have been 13 or 14 episodes. Flash certainly could have been 13. Arrow could have been 10. So like all these shows could be a lot more concise. And they could take some pages from Netflix where, I mean, obviously for network television, you can't vary the show length. Like something I really enjoy about Netflix originals is that if it's a 45-minute show, then that's how long it has to be because the next episode might be 55. You know, it might be 57. They bounce around in that realm, but they always kind of edit it to be however the show needs because they don't have to accommodate commercials and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's my, I mean, I understand that there's some tie-ins there or some restrictions with network television. The nerdy answer that I have for the pierced ears is actually pretty simple. When Clark left Krypton, he was an infant. When Kara left Krypton, she was like 10 or 12. Her ears were already pierced before she left Krypton. So there's that.
Look at you, Mr. Cannon.
Yeah. I don't even know if it was Cannon. I think it was in the show. Like I'm pretty sure her ears are pierced in the intro. I could be wrong. I could be completely wrong. At which point my other nerdy answer would be Superman pierced them for her. Like I don't know.
They had a nail painting party and she pierced her ears like in Greece.
Ah, there you go. There you go. But I like questions like that. Once the season is over and people want to kind of drill down into stuff like that, I'm okay with it. I'm not so sure about the whole Manhunter thing. I didn't realize at first that it was going to be Martian Manhunter. I had a hunch after they flashed the red eyes, but my hunch originally, and I remember you and I and Sadie talked about this too, Hammond.
Sid, sorry.
Was that the red eyes made it look like Henshaw was a villain.
Yeah, that's kind of where we all landed at first.
Yeah. I mean, it was up until he did something good. Right. So I think they did a good job with that. I'll disagree with you softly, John, and say that they didn't kind of beat you over the head with the Martian Manhunter, but everything else, the whole girl thing and my cousin Clark and Superman and not being able to say Superman, like they kind of beat you over the head with it. I agree.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, Sid kept watching, I fell off after the episode where they ripped off Star Trek's Inner Light episode with the alien plant thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was done after that. And from what Sid said, it might be a good thing that I fell off because it just wasn't my type of show anymore.
No, they did. They switched, especially the season finale was very touchy-feely.
Yeah.
And I agree with all the stuff that John said about the end fight. That was... Again, Supergirl wasn't doing the things that John described in the email because it wasn't in the script. You know, it's like, it's the same reason that Zoom, the villain in Flash, hasn't killed everybody because he's kicked everyone's butt from here to Central City. And it, like, there's been opportunities to end everybody, and he just hasn't, because he hasn't felt like it. And like that, that to me really bothers me. It's a weak, weak villain, and it's weak writing.
Wait, is Flash and Zoom still a thing? That's another show that I gave up on. I couldn't.
They're still a thing. Bring back the talking gorilla.
Or the shark thing.
Yeah, actually the shark, killer King Shark was awesome. He was actually kind of cool. Some of the villains I understand are kooky, but they handled the King Shark thing really well. You know, like they explained a lot of that stuff.
Only in like 5 minutes of it.
Yeah, my dad had the same problem with Flash that a lot of people do, which is the whole two Earth thing, like the multi-dimensional explanation stuff. Like I get that it's far-fetched. It's also comic books. Like I kind of I'll give them some leeway. The problem that I have, and I know I've said this on the show before, doesn't matter how far-fetched your premise is, whether it's a speedster, whether it's a guy that dresses up like a bat, you know, whether it's a guy that puts on an iron suit and fights a guy that wears a flag on his chest. Like it doesn't matter how weird that is. If the characters, if the people in your story are not reacting in a logical way, it all falls apart. You know, like if the person's a megalomaniacal villain, have them act like that, but have them 100% do it. Don't have them falter. Don't have them back up for just a minute. And we'll have the exact opposite of that happening later on when we talk about Game of Thrones. So
here's the thing that I think makes the best villains, though, and makes them most interesting. It's when you have a villain who's acting because he thinks what he's doing is for good. Mm-hmm. That he's not the bad guy in his own story.
Right.
That's what makes him so interesting. And that's actually one of the things, like the second Planet of the Apes movie that came out. That was great because there were three groups in that movie, three people, mm-hmm. who were doing what they thought was right. There was the rebel ape guy, the one that kind of the ape character that kind of went off on his own. There was Commissioner Gordon's character that was doing what he thought was best. And then there was Marky Mark and his Funky Bunch who thought they were doing what they were best. Mm-hmm. And between the three groups, it created this conflict because they each thought they were in the right. Mm-hmm. And that's where the bad guys were established, because they thought they were acting in what was best for the community.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that kind of stuff is best. I mean, I'm okay with villains being villains too, but they waver, I find, in these TV shows lately. Like, for example, they were setting up Max Lord in Supergirl to be a nemesis, like to be the Lex Luthor of that series. And they got him partway there, and then they backpedaled. And I don't know why. I have no idea whether it was because they wanted to drum up some sort of season two love interest between Alex and him or whatever. It just did not make sense. He also doesn't strike me as the best casting for that role either. You know, like usually villains, you tend to not like them. They tend to have their own agendas. It's better when... I'm not saying I want them to telegraph everything. Like, I don't want to know their next move before they make it. But I enjoy knowing that they're evil, but then not knowing what they're going to do next. Like, that's kind of where I...
Well, I still think he's asleep. I think he's a sleeper cell. And the next season, he'll show true color. And since he's on the inside, it'll wreak havoc.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I have higher hopes for second seasons of most shows, only because they're no longer trying to please everybody. Like they've landed a second season. They have one under their belt. They know they can do it. They've got some good episodes. Something that Alistair pointed out to me a little while ago, just in a kind of an off-air conversation, was that he pays attention when the show is written by the showrunners, like the people that created the series. When those episodes show up, I think he was talking about Smallville actually, but when those episodes show up, they tend to be awesome episodes because they're the people that understand the characters, that understand the pacing, that understand the actors and like all that kind of stuff. Whereas like, you know, Monster of the Week is not usually handled by those folks, and it's like a filler episode, and they're not always the greatest. So it's interesting to me. I should go back and look at the Supergirl roster of episodes and see where the showrunners wrote them and where they stepped aside and let other people have a crack at it. So I'd be curious to see how that goes next season. But speaking of all this television, we should probably move into our highlight reel for this evening. And that is, of course, the Winter is Coming segment. If you are not caught up on Game of Thrones Season 6, Episode 2, now is the time for you to part ways with us. We are going to spoil this episode. So we enjoy it, but if you haven't seen it, it's probably going to piss you off royally. So I apologize. Come back and listen later if you dare. Dun, dun, dun. So this week, the episode is called Home, episode 2, as I mentioned. Walda gives birth to a baby boy, prompting Ramsay to murder Roose, Walda, and his new half-brother. Lovely. Brienne reveals to Sansa that Arya is still alive. Theon requests a return to the Iron Islands, where his uncle, Euron Greyjoy, returns and murders King Balon Greyjoy. Lots of murdering going on. In Braavos, Arya is attacked by the Waif before Jaqen H'ghar appears to order and orders her to follow him. Tyrion learns that Astapor and Yunkai have returned to slavery and releases Rhaegal and Viserion from their chains. Those are the dragons, by the way. Bran visits Winterfell in a vision and sees Ned, Benjen, and Lyanna Stark, as well as a young Hodor. All of them were kids at this time, actually, which is really cool. Jaime confronts the High Sparrow, while Tommen asks Cersei to teach him to be strong. Ed arrives with Tormund and the Wildlings and imprisons the Thorn, the guy that usurped the Night's Watch, and the other mutineers. Davos, persuades Melisandre to attempt to resurrect Jon Snow, though apparently unsuccessful after the Loyalists leave the room, Jon suddenly awakens. So there is the entire show summarized and spoiled all in one go. I really enjoy, I really enjoyed the summary better than last week. I'm not sure who might have written it, but it's way more concise.
Well, and also it was covering actual things, because nothing really happened last week.
That's the thing, and the summary was like twice as long. It was like murder to read.
Did the giant smash you against the wall, or did the mountain push you under the wall?
And there we have the theme for this episode: head meet wall, splat.
I mean, there were, the wall had a higher body count than swords did in this episode.
You're so right. You're so right. And that is not how I want to go. Oh God.
I really felt bad for the guy at Castle Black. Because the giant just snatched him off the balcony and whack, and then threw him in front of the bad guy.
Yeah. See, the guy that was pissing in the alley that died, he didn't see it coming. He was just too drunk to care. He felt nothing.
I like the fact that he pissed on the mountain's feet for a while.
Yeah.
Before it happened.
Turned around, still urinating. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. But there's that unbearable moment between when the giant grabs you and pulls you from the rampart to when your head actually hits the wall, when he's flinging you full 180 to know what's coming. Like, no thanks. No thanks. Lesson: do not frig with giants ever. I'm trying to not swear too much on the show, but it meant wow.
yeah.
And this is the thing. I mean, my general thoughts on this week's episode was, this was a Game of Thrones episode, and this should have been what they led the season with. You would have had everybody on the edge of their chairs.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I can understand if they wanted to hold it to episode 2 would be the John resurrection thing. Like, that's the only thing that I could see.
You mean the thing that we all knew was going to happen at some point, we just didn't know when?
Well, yeah, and I'm disappointed too. And it sounds funny, because John is one of my favorite characters. He's one of my favorite actors on the show. Yet, we now enter this lovely kind of world of comic book logic where even death isn't permanent. Yay. So I don't...
But that's two people now. We've got the Mountain, who's been reanimated.
Yeah.
And we got John and the entire village of wildlings.
Yeah. So, entire village of wildlings.
Yeah. End of last season with the battle.
Oh, okay. So, well, we already knew that people can come back from the whites, though. Like, yeah. That's one thing. But those are also all, I mean, okay. So, I understand that resurrection and stuff. And that's been a thing since the very beginning of the series with dead people rising in the north as whites. Like, I get that. The White Walkers have the ability to raise the dead as, what are they called? Scourge, that sort of thing. But it's never happened to main characters, main family line characters. And when the Mountain was resurrected, there are some serious consequences there. Like, we don't know what he looks like. He looks kind of purple. Like, I'm assuming it's not a pretty picture under the armor. And that's why he's got the helmet on. So to know that John, and there was a lot of stab wounds, like he was D-E-double-E dead. And to have him come back with, so far, I mean, we don't know very much, no consequences, seems odd. It seems, I mean, it's not, I mean, we're in brand new territory. The scene where John is stabbed and left bleeding on the snow at the end of last season, that's how the book ends, in book five. So no one knows where John's story goes beyond that. So now we're all in new territory. So it's interesting to watch, but I'm a little disappointed. I mean, as much as I would miss John, I almost want him to stay dead or to come back, as some people has predicted, as like, as a White Walker, like real bad, be the, yeah, the bad guy. You know, I mean, yeah, the whole thing is called A Song of Ice and Fire, and people are often thinking like, you know, John and Daenerys eventually being like a thing, because like they're the two fan favorites usually. But I mean, I would have liked to have seen it like, well, not have them team up to save the day. What if John is actually the bad guy to face? Like, what if he becomes the lieutenant of the Lich King sort of idea? Lich King sort of thing. Yeah. But like that, I mean,
what,
that
see what I did there? Wow.
Yeah. 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 And I did that too. I've got wow on the brain. But that's the thing. Like, that would be more interesting to me, and it would keep John in the show. Like, it just, you know, there's a little bit. So, I mean, I'm not complaining, but it just, it seems like I don't want everybody to be able to come back to life at the moment's notice.
I don't think the two guys who met Wall are coming back.
Well, okay, yes, very true. But like, for example, if someone killed Tyrion, I don't want them to bring him back. You know what I mean? Like, if Tyrion dies, and again, we don't know because it's well beyond in the books. I would expect that to be a very important, poignant part of the series, and it would be finite. Like, I don't want, you know, I don't want that yo-yo effect to happen. And the thing is, there are other situations in the books, and I'm going to be very careful how I word this, where people have come back to life. We met somebody in the series. He was a knight, and I do not remember his name because there's too many names to remember in the series. But he was the Fire Knight or something. He, I think Arya and the Hound encountered them on the way north at some point. Okay. Anyway, he and another character have gained the ability to come back to life one way or another, in different ways than the Mountain and in different ways than John. And it actually works. It makes sense. But it's not just a clean, they're back. Like, there's a heavy, heavy price. So that to me is a better way of handling it than just like, well, we can't kill him because everybody loves him and we need to bring him back. Like that feels, it almost feels like a decision made in service of the show as opposed to a decision made in service of the story. But that's just, again, it's just my two cents. Did you like that scene when they brought him back?
I did. It's funny. At first, I had this idea that he was pulling a Bran and hanging out in the Wolf. And then as his body was recovered by magic, he jumped back into his body because he could.
Hmm.
But that was one theory a friend of mine had mentioned.
Yeah, that's cool.
And when I saw it, I'm like, yeah, I guess maybe that could be a thing. But once I saw it, I realized it wasn't that. The Wolf was stirring because he knew John was coming back.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely tied because, Bran uses Summer as a, is it Summer? Yeah. Shaggy Dog is Rickon's wolf. So Summer is Bran's wolf. Bran uses Summer as a transport. Like he projects himself into the wolf, which I think is really cool. So he's got more of a connection with his wolf than the other ones do, but they always had that kind of interesting connection because I think they don't really get into it too much, but in the books, there's definitely something mystical about the dire wolves too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing that stood out for me, well, let's do the Boltons first, since that's sure. What you have at the top. The concept of feeding your stepmother and baby half-brother to dogs and watching it unaffected was really profound. That showed a level of his character that we kind of suspected, but that was a brutality that was even extreme for him.
Yeah, and it's funny how quickly we forget. I mean, Joffrey was the one that was putting crossbow bolts in, you know, a hooker in his bedroom for fun.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, he was torturous with Sansa. He, you know, I can't remember anything else that he might have done. But the list was long. The first thing that happens in the series is Jaime pushes a 6-year-old at a window. like, or a 10-year-old, whatever, brand gets pushed out a window. So, like, that kind of stuff has been in the show, but it has not been in the show as of late. And I agree that, you know, deep down, because of what he's done to Theon Greyjoy, because of the other girl, there was somebody, one of the first introductions to Ramsay was he had dogs hunting down someone that was running through the woods. I can't remember whether it was a guy or a girl, but it was frightful.
Yeah.
They're big, angry hunting dogs. And it, like, you know he's capable of it, but he always seemed to have a collar, right? Like, he was the dog on the leash, and it was always pleasing dad. It was always, you know, getting that approval, climbing that ladder. But then I didn't really notice any dissent last season.
Well,
maybe with the marriage thing.
Yeah, I was going to say there is that moment with Sansa that was pretty rough.
Oh no, I knew that. Like, yeah, I mean, there's certain things that he's done, but I mean, like, I don't remember him disobeying.
No, this is a different level. Bruce. This is a this is a very different level. My only hope here is that he decides he's going to try to take Castle Black, and Giant Man just steps on him.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like I mean, we needed someone to love to hate, right? I mean, he's a great actor, and he's frightening. Like, I don't look at that and say, oh, that guy's doing a really good job playing Ramsay. I look at that going, Ramsay, I hate you. You're just a despicable person. Like, it just, you know, everything washes away and you're just kind of lost in those moments. I mean, you kind of get from his lead into it that, okay, he's obviously going to be on outs with dad this season because, you know, his dad has got a son, you know, but his dad says, you're always going to be my firstborn. So you think, okay, well, this is going to last, you know, there's probably going to be some sort of dissent, but it'll happen some way through the season. Did not see him stabbing him in that embrace. Like, that was just like, whoa, it's on now. And that's when my ears kind of perked up, for this episode. And I thought, okay, are we back? Are we back to fine form? And we are, you know, I really enjoyed this episode. I don't apologize for ragging on last week because it was weak, but this episode really kind of twisted the knife, if you pardon the pun, as far as driving home what Game of Thrones is all about. You know, the murder and the deceit and the stuff that you just don't see coming. Main characters, people in the credits that just don't make it. Like, I mean, you need to be that kind of edge of seat for this season to really kind of keep people going, I think.
Yeah. And the interesting, the thing I really enjoy now is Ramsay makes a great big bad because there really isn't anybody else. The guy from Castle Black has now been defeated and in cells. We actually have had a moment where we feel sorry for Cersei now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She needs to regain her overall evil because right now we feel for her.
Mm-hmm.
And Jaime, since he lost his hand and got a haircut, he's been actually one of the stronger, more moral characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, so all the people we really hated, they've all kind of shifted and we have feelings for. So having something out there that we really can hate and kind of hang our hate on is good because for a while we didn't have anybody.
Yeah, I mean, and feeding his stepmother and baby to the dogs was like the message drilled home to viewers, like, you are not going to like what this guy's going to do this season.
Yeah. And when something does happen to him, you're going to stand up and cheer.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the thing is, like, I mean, if any of the main characters that we adore get captured by him and he's walking towards them, like, you don't know. Like, He stabbed his dad, who has been a main character in the series forever, in the second episode, right? So, I mean, like, the message is clear. No one is safe. You know, like, it's a big deal, and I'm on board. I mean, speaking of Cersei and Jaime, I feel that Cersei's role this year, it's not that she's going to be doing any outright evil to others, but I think we're all going to be pretty pissed off watching her contort Tommen into an asshole.
Yeah, I think she's going to use Tommen to be her voice, mm-hmm. and she's going to use the mountain to be her muscle,
mm-hmm.
and she's going to find a way to manipulate them to get the revenge that she feels like she needs. Mm-hmm. And then Jamie is going to do what Jamie feels is doing what he needs to do to protect his family. So I think there's going to be a lot of consternation and things happening there because they're a family under assault. Mm-hmm. And when a family is put under assault like that, they tend to do crazy and extreme things.
Yeah. And all for, as you mentioned earlier, what they feel is right.
Yeah.
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 No, I agree. And that is where I think the other extreme comes in for the other, in my mind, the other big bad in the series right now is the High Sparrow.
What, are you such a jerk?
Oh, well, I mean, and he hides behind the kind of absolutism that I find terrifying. Like for him, I mean, he stands there and confronts Jamie in the sept, and I mean, Jamie has him dead to rights. Like you just, you know, I could breathe on you and kill you. And then all these followers, the, what are they called? Not the sparrows. It's the
free. I don't know.
No, I don't remember what they're called.
The mindless horde of,
yeah.
Of toga wearing scarheads.
Yeah, I mean, so they're tearing down the monarchy is basically what their procedure is, it seems like. But it's this twofold. It's this double-sided, we're going to bring you down because you're corrupted and sinful and deceitful and blah, but we're perfectly willing to beat you to death with a bloody axe and call it holy. And it, ugh, like that kind of stuff makes my skin crawl. And again, good villain. Like I'm glad that he's in it because it irritates me to a point where I know that it's doing its job, you know, like it just, ugh,
and he's a very, very different type of villain than Bolton is.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
The two of them could never be on the same side of any argument.
Nope.
So it's not like Japan and Germany as Axis and allies kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. These are two people with such distinct values that if they met and they said, hey, let's work together, the Sparrow would probably go after Bolton Ramsey because of his sins.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no, and I think that, I mean, there's so many faults in the characters in the show. It's what makes it so interesting, right? Like, we've mentioned time and time again that there's no black and white. It's all very gray. And it's... I mean, I don't say that there's any real white in what the High Sparrow and his followers are doing, but there's, in their minds, there's a clear, you know, mission. But man, they do not deviate, and that's what I find so scary.
Yeah. I liked the stuff with Sansa and...
Oh, yeah, Brienne and Theon?
Yeah, that was really good. It was a small scene, but it set up what happened at the Iron Isles and his sister kind of getting smacked down by someone who is throwing out the patriarchal laws or whatever, which yep. is frustrating.
Yeah. That sort of situation is how the fourth book starts. And we've never been there in the books. And it's very confusing because you're introduced to the Iron Islands, the hierarchy, the monarchy, the laws, the way that they do things. And it's just a whole lot of stuff to take in after just learning over three books how Westeros generally works, you know, and then you have to learn it all over again. So they're doing a little bit of a better job in the show by having it be character-driven dialogue as opposed to in the books, of course, it's a narration.
So it's more like a manifesto than a...
Yeah, yeah, or an inner monologue for, I can't remember her name.
His sister.
Theon's sister, yeah.
Who I think I'm actually gonna like. I think I've always kind of liked her, mm-hmm. but I think I'm actually gonna really like her as the season progresses.
Yeah,
I could be way wrong, but I think so.
Yeah, actually, she's not mentioned in the summary, which is weird. But yeah, she's and I always forget her name because it's a different name in the books than it is in the TV show. But yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be an interesting battle to see what happens with that kind of, strong woman in a very kind of man driven, you know, Iron Islands strength, you know, society. What I found
I thought it was weird. They wrapped him up like sushi before they set him out on the barge.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all very, like Neptune, god of the sea type stuff with those guys. What I found really interesting, and I've spoken to my sister about this before, in the books, there's no brother, or at least that's not how he dies. The king, Balin Greyjoy, is on a bridge, and he literally just falls off. He's blown away by a storm, and that's it. It was the most anticlimactic death to one of the main kind of antagonists in the freaking books. And you're just kind of like, wait a minute, what? He fell? That's it? Like, there's no, like, you're expecting an arrow from a rooftop or like something. Nope, nothing. So I think that's why there was all this dialogue in the show about the brother being crazy and tied to a mast and I am the storm, brother. Like, it's just like, because in the books, that's really what it was, the storm.
Which, that right there, your quote throws all the way back to my initial summation of this thing, that it's WWF, because you just pulled out the ultimate WWF line.
Nice.
I am the storm, brother. Take your medicine.
Brother? That's not, I never even clued in. You know, in the show, they're using it in context like he really is his brother. But the Hulk Hogan way, it's way better. Way better. That's what I want. I want Hulk Hogan in Game of Thrones. Oh, my God. That would be so amazing. You imagine? You're walking into... Into Hulkamania, the realm of Hulk Hogan.
Yes. Welcome to the land of Hulkster.
Yeah, and everybody barges in, and he tries to talk any sense into him, and he's like, what you gonna do, brother?
Yep. It's a whole culture of tearing your shirts off before you shake.
That's awesome. Take a really long time with all the armor that they wear in this show.
Yeah.
It's just like, hold on a second, I have to tear my tank top off. Although I would kill to see the bright yellow and red.
Yes, the that would be the banner of Hulkland.
Yeah.
Yeah. The dragons. Let's talk about the dragons for a second.
Let's talk about the dragons. They're always my favorite. They always steal the show.
So I don't know when it happened, but I remember vaguely in my memory of power watching this show that Tyrion's father made a comment at some point about, you're no son of mine.
Yes.
So was he speaking figuratively or literally? Because if he's speaking literally, which makes me wonder if he might be the lost Targaryen, because the way he was able to handle the dragons.
No. As far as I know, Finite. I know for sure. Tyrion killed his mom when he was born.
Okay. Like
that,
all right.
That labor, she didn't make it through it.
So he was speaking figuratively when he said that.
Yeah. He was basically disowning him because of how he was treating the family name or how he was conducting business.
Okay. Just checking.
I know that quote and I'm trying to remember what exactly Tyrion did. I don't recall.
And was it because he was shacking up with the lady friend he had?
No, it wasn't the lady friend. It was something to do with what he did. It was like how he handled the king. Maybe it was because Joffrey died. It was something extreme. It was something extreme for sure.
Well, I was just checking because the way he was able to walk up, have a conversation with the dragons, they totally let him do it and hang out with him, and he pet them for a while and let them go, and they didn't cook him, they didn't eat him, they didn't do anything. And then he walked up the stairs and told his friend the eunuch that if he ever had an idea like that again, he'd punch him in the face.
And I mean, so, I which was a fun little line. I mean, the best line of the show was, I drink and I know things, it's what I do.
Yes, that was a great line.
Yeah, and that was kind of what led him down into the dungeon. But I agree with you. And I had this conversation again with Andrea because we were talking about it afterwards. And I don't know, or it wasn't communicated clearly enough to me, where Tyrion picked up the knowledge on how to treat a dragon so that it didn't find you threatening, or why it worked given the situation, and we'll call it training, that Viserion and Rhaegal have had, right? They've been chained. They've been confronted. There have been, you know, people get thrown down there. We've seen them eat people before. So I don't know what he did differently. Andrea pointed out that he bowed.
Yes, he did that. And also, he did say that they are smarter and more intelligent than we give them credit for.
Yes.
And so maybe the way he showed the respect, I mean, he did bow, but also the fact he was talking to them the entire time, not as if they were dragons or pets, but as if they were these majestic things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That might have helped because they realized also being who he is and what he is, maybe they didn't see him as a threat.
That's the other thing too, is that he is, I mean, stature is a thing. He didn't have a weapon. He had a torch, but I mean, they're not
afraid. And he put that down.
And they're not afraid of fire. So, I mean, like, that's not a thing.
Yeah.
And you're right. He put that down too, but he didn't put it down at first. Like, there was a point where he was close enough to be eaten and he still had the torch. And now I understand after he released the first one, I get everything else. Everything else came in the line, how they behave, how the second dragon, I can't remember, I don't know which is which, but when the second dragon turned his head to have Tyrion unlock him, like, I mean, I understand that. I'm excited that he has their trust now, or at least that's what we're supposed to believe. Like, that is really cool. But there was something, like, I feel like there could have been a smart aleck remark from Tyrion that wasn't so vague about, like, I know things. I wish he could have said something along the lines of, like, I've read how to behave in front of them, or I read once that there was this thing, maybe if I try that, like, even if it was just this little hint of something. I mean, there was just too much reading between the lines to make that theme seem completely seamless to me. But man, did the dragons ever look good. Like,
and he did actually drop the hint that he was fascinated by him, and that so as he's moving toward them, he does tip his hat that he knows more about them than we thought he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it was a little bit too, I don't know. The whole time I was just thinking, like, I was hoping, like, he could, I didn't think he was going to tell everybody, but it would have been cool if, as he was walking towards them, he was saying something for Vari's benefit, but also ours.
Yeah.
Right.
What's this line you have in here about pickles?
Oh, in the notes I put down, maybe dragons don't like pickles because Tyrion drinks so much.
Oh, okay. He's basically, all right.
Pickled. I thought that was where my head was at when I made the notes this afternoon. I went back and I was thinking about it. I was like, I don't know. He wouldn't taste very good. It would basically taste like dwarf and wine. Like, I don't know. I'm not sure how well that would go. But yeah, the other thing that I remember from when they ate the other people is that there was lots of other people down there and several of them had spears. Like, the dragons were definitely on alert defense, you know, like sharp things. So with Tyrion going down so passively, I'm curious to see what happens next. You know, they're still locked up down there, but I'd be curious to see if we get more.
I thought they went out like a back door or something. I didn't realize that they were still under the pyramid. I thought maybe they went out the garage door or something.
No, I think that's the only way in and out. And I'm not entirely, I mean, they're pretty slender. I think if they squish down, they could probably get out that door, but no, they're, as far as I know, she brought them down there when they were a lot smaller.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that means the pyramid might get destroyed at some point this season.
Potentially, yeah. Again, I don't recall. It's something I really enjoy about this season is that in many ways they're moving beyond the books, or they're into places, things that were just kind of touched on and not really flushed out. So I don't really know what's going to happen next, which I find really entertaining. Any final thoughts on this episode?
We didn't really talk about Bran and Green, but to be honest with you, I thought it was meh. I thought the vision was cool. It kind of filled you in on a couple of things about Willis.
Yeah, and Hodor.
Which was strange, yeah. But other than that, it didn't mean anything to me, so we'll see how that pans out.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind seeing a little bit more of the Stark family, like, because, I mean, Ned Stark dies in the first season. Lyanna is already dead. And she was the whole reason the war started. I mean, Robert Baratheon was in love and was supposed to marry Lyanna, and then she was kidnapped by the Mad King Targaryen. So, like, that's how the whole landslide started. So I wouldn't mind seeing more of that in a vision when they weren't kids, but maybe when they were adults. I think that would be really cool. Be interesting, even if it was to bring, you know, Sean Bean, and I don't remember the other guy's name, but back for an episode, like, just to kind of do something cool. I think that would be kind of neat.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to next week. I'm interested to see what the consequences of Jon Snow are. I'm interested to see what the consequences for Bolton are.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I'm excited to see an episode where it's not beat the blind girl with a stick.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. It was nice. Yeah. I'm glad. I like your notes where it was bad thing, Beat the Blind Girl with a Stick. Good thing, only two episodes of it.
Yeah. Time to move on. Because again, Arya's got a very interesting story, and I'm excited to see that unfold.
I still think the guy who plays the Faceless Man needs to be the new Highlander.
Ooh, yes. I agree. But he can't be many faces because there can be only one.
Yes, well, you know. But I think he'd be awesome because he kind of looks like Lambert.
Yeah, a little bit.
And he kind of sounds a little bit like him. And I think that he'd make a great Highlander if they ever decided to reboot it.
Yeah, that would be cool. Those movies would have to get a lot better, but that's just...
They've only got one way to go, man.
Well, that's true. That's very, very true. Well, we will wrap up this episode with the Internet Minute. That's brought to you by Tweaked Audio. You can go to tweakedaudio.com for high-performance noise-reducing earbuds. Use the code TCC at checkout for 30% off and your entire... Sorry, 30% off and free shipping on your entire order. That's TCC at checkout, tweakedaudio.com. My Internet Minute this week comes to you as of May the 4th be with you. I thought it'd be, I guess, appropriate to have a Star Wars pick this week. And I don't recall who sent this to me. I found it on Facebook. I don't know who sent it. It was maybe somebody in the Tadpool and the Frog Pants community. But it is a custom Lego Star Destroyer, so huge it has a three-level interior. And it is literally 20 times the volume of the official released Star Destroyer from Lego. Madness.
That's nuts.
This thing is the size of a pool table, and I want one.
The thing that's interesting is the table they have it on in the picture has steel legs, and I think that's for a reason, because I bet that thing weighs an absolute ton.
It would be pretty heavy, yeah. I mean, it's not solid. There's lots of inner structure and hollow parts. Like you can sort of see, like, there's the bridge, and then there's the two tiers. And so you take the top piece off, and there's the second tier, and then you take the whole upper portion. So not the triangle of the Star Destroyer, but you take the whole upper portion off, and then there's like a hangar bay and a detention level and a walkway and all this kind of stuff. And I don't know how on earth, I mean, it's all Lego, but some of it must be like custom pieces or something. Like, I don't know how you get certain pieces that size to make it, or how you would find the instructions, or like, I mean, that kind of stuff is beyond me. It's a really interesting Kotaku article. You can go in and check it out. And there's lots of pictures. There's a link in the article for even more interior pictures, which is really cool. But it is a massive, massive undertaking. And that's the kind of thing that, I mean, that would be just so much fun. You know, every Saturday night, just kind of chilling with a glass of scotch and putting together your Star Destroyer. Not hard to tell I'm a giant nerd, but still, like, that, I don't know, that's really, really cool. I will have some pictures and stuff in the show notes as well. What's your pick this week, man?
I found a documentary about the Thunderbirds.
Oh, nice.
It's the super marionation kind of thing. It's this 35-minute documentary about how they were made and how they did these. They found these audio-only productions of the Thunderbirds, and so they actually made new Thunderbird episodes based on these audio-only episodes. It's cool. It's really cool. They talk about how they made the puppets originally and how they moved it forward with technology and how they mimicked how the things were shot and how they were, you know, just all the techniques they used to keep it within the same vein.
Nice.
And it's super interesting, and it makes me want to get one of those. I want to have one of those puppets.
Yeah, I remember watching Thunderbirds with my dad when I was a kid.
Yeah, I forgot how much I liked it until I started watching this documentary. So now I'm kind of like, okay, let's find the Scarlet, what's it called? There are like three or four series that this type of puppetry was used on, and I want to watch all of them now.
Yeah, no, I think the nostalgia train, as strong as it is these days, you could probably find that on a digital download easy enough on maybe not Netflix. It might be in Netflix in the States.
Actually, I think Hulu or Amazon has the Thunderbirds or Fireball X11 or X1 or whatever it's called streaming.
Yeah. And if not, I mean, it can't be that expensive to just buy it.
Yeah. You know? And to be really honest with you, if I really want to get a fix, I can always just watch Team America.
Yeah. I was trying to remember the name of that as you were speaking. and I don't remember if I saw that or if I've only seen parts of it. I think I've only seen parts of it. Struck me as something that was playing in someone's dorm room when I was in university. It was never my cup of tea.
There are moments of it that I think are absolute genius, and there's other stuff where it's just a little bit too much.
Yeah, that's usually my beef with with is Trey Parker.
That's yeah,
the, uh-huh. yep. South Park guy.
Yep.
I find one episode of South Park pretty funny sometimes, but you know, like for me to watch it every week, nope, was not a.
Yeah, I have to be told you need to watch this one, and then I'll go find it and watch
yeah.
it. I can't. I like when I had my shoulder surgery, I tried to binge watch the first couple seasons because I had nothing else to do, mm-hmm. and I got tired after about three episodes. It was just it has its moments, but I felt kind of a beat up by it.
Yeah. And that's the same thing with Family Guy, Futurama. I mean, I find that when comedy like that, especially cartoons are kind of pushing those buttons, they're meant to in very small doses and in places apart. They work way better as a weekly television show for 20 minutes than they do as a sit down and watch three or four of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the Family Guy was kind of meant to shock.
The Wow episode was great of, South Park. Yeah, I've seen that, yeah. The magic episode was really funny. I don't know anything about magic, but the fact that I know like Garrett and mm-hmm. that made it funny just yep. because of them.
Yep. Yeah. When you get some inside information, it kind of, you know, any kind of pop culture that you're just kind of familiar with, it's generally good enough that you can.
Well, it's just like there's a movie, Waiting for Guffman, that the Spinal Tap guys did, Christopher Guest and all them. I worked in theater for so long that show rings so true for amateur public theater that it hurts. But for people who've never worked in that field or never had to deal with that kind of mentality, it's funny, but it doesn't have the same kind of resonance. And just like if you've never played in a band that toured with, you know, and you had those typical things, Spinal Tap's funny, but it doesn't hit home and like punch in the gut.
Yeah.
There are moments in Spinal Tap that I actually saw happen on stages.
Yeah. Yeah. I never got into theater in front of or behind scenes. It's funny. It's probably the artist in me. I've always just been happy to do my theater with characters and pencils as opposed to the other way around. I mean, it's probably why I was in animation, you know, actor with a pencil.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you stare in the mirror and make funny faces and then draw versions of them on paper.
Far too often. Yep. Absolutely. I keep a mirror by my drawing table for reference. Like a quick Google search is fun, but sometimes you just can't find the right angle for that, you know, hand coming at the screen. So you're just like, well, screw it. Where's the mirror? You know, or where's my phone? I use my phone a lot. You know, take a reference photo here and there. It's technology these days is fantastic. Like I sound like I'm, you know, some old man talking on the porch, but you know, I remember working in animation when it wasn't such a great, like Google Image was still there, but it wasn't as prevalent and it wasn't as robust. Or the search controls weren't there, so you couldn't do it at work because you're searching for like female hero pose and like you don't know what kind of porn is going to come up. Like it was sketchy. But now, I mean, man, you can find all kinds of reference. Pinterest is just fantastic. All these people that have done all the hard work for you, and you're just like, I'm looking for, you know, femur reference on, you know, for artists. And it's just like, bam, anatomy posts from all kinds of different places. And it's all art. Like that kind of stuff is just amazing and all it is just like, I just need to figure out how to draw this guy's finger. You're just looking for that, the right pose and a hand somewhere online. And you can usually find it, which is kind of cool. But again, like a lot of times, if I can't find it in the first 30 seconds, I don't lose myself. I'll just grab a mirror and try to sort it out.
Yeah, well, that's cool.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Citadel Cafe. Thank you for coming along for the ride. You can get on the ride every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on thecitadelcafe.com. The mobile audio stream is provided by alphageekradio.com, and the music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod. You can email the show, just like John, at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com, or find us by name on Twitter and Facebook. One of the best ways for the show to reach new listeners is with an iTunes review. If you like the show, pop on over to iTunes and leave us a 3 or a 4 or 5-star review, and I'll read your name right here, including any comments you might have for myself, Hammond, Lou, or Brockett. If you would like to support the show in another way and join the Slack chat with all the cool people that talk in between shows about all the fun stuff that we talk about on the show, go to patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. You can check out what we're doing there. It's a very simple setup. It's just basically support us in any way that you see fit. If supporting us financially is not something that you can do, iTunes review, or hey, share the Patreon page on your Facebook post or on your Twitter. It's any kind of just eyes on Patreon is always good for the show. So that's patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am up to online at joelduggan.com, including my new publishing company, Forge Publishing. There's a post on my blog about it. You can go to forgepublishing.com if you'd like to check out a painting by Piper Thibodeau and sign up for the newsletter to find out more about her upcoming book. I had a big meeting with Piper this morning. Things are moving along. I'm going to be putting out the first newsletter in the next week or so. So head on over to forgepublishing.com and sign up if that's something that would interest you. Beyond that, you can find me by my name on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Just look up Joel Duggan. And if you find artwork or pancakes, it is probably me. Hammond, where can people find you online?
I'm at J Hammond C on Twitter. I do a show called Beyond the Playlist with J Hammond C. And sometime probably late summer, we'll be launching Soundography with Brian Ibbett.
I am excited. I actually had another kind of email meeting with Brian earlier this week. So the balls are rolling all over the place here. You have been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick 2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2. Giant dork, but that's okay.
This podcast recorded before a live internet audience. To learn how to listen and watch live, visit tunein.alphageekradio.com.